Welcome to the Urantia Radio Podcast. It's good to be back, and it's good to have you with me. And it means so much to me, whenever I look and see how many people are tuning in, it just blows me away. And I'm just honored and humbled and actually quite humbled, because it's just such a fortuitous thing that I can do these things for the passion that I have for the Urantia book and the Urantia papers. William Sadler said, of all of his accomplishments, and boy, he had quite a few, he said his greatest accomplishment was the one that he was not known for, and that was, of course, the Urantia book. And I feel the same way. So few of my close associates, and not because I haven't tried, mind you, are just so completely unaware of the Urantia papers that it is, sometimes it's troubling, but I understand the human condition, and people are slow to change. I'm always, and I don't know if you're a longtime reader, maybe you could relate to me on this one, but I'm always amazed that nobody asks questions. I think that if you're a Mormon, or even if you're a Muslim, and maybe you've had this experience, people will ask you, somehow it'll come up in a conversation, what your faith is. People don't ask you questions, or maybe they do, but a small percentage. A small percentage of people will ask you specific questions, or they'll pull you aside, right? But it's never happened to me. In my 30-something years of reading this book, and as much as I've spoken to people about it, nobody ever asks. Just, it's an amazing. And I think they know why they don't ask. Because they don't want to go there yet. That's the issue. I consider myself the luckiest person on the planet, because I've had this book in my life. The door has been opened to me. I can see what's on the other side of that door. But through my faith in this book as a touchstone to the conceptual reality that I hold true about the Urantia book and its narrative, I actually feel like I have a look into the keyhole, into the true reality that surrounds us, the true reality that we don't see in everyday life, the comings and goings of the spiritual ministers over long periods of time, duties that are accomplished by certain people. Because this is a process. Evolution is a process. It's God's way of doing things. It's God's way of doing things in an eternal time reference. He could take as much time as he wants to get to the point where the supreme being emerges. And then what happens after that? God isn't in a hurry, because time doesn't matter to him. It's irrelevant. So speaking of that, I wanted to just share with you, and we're going to read from paper 196 today, which is the Faith of Jesus. It's the final set of papers in the Urantia book, the final set of 196 papers. And now, for those who may know, or forgive my repetitiveness on this, but the Midwayer Commission are the collective authors of the Urantia book papers. They're not identified by specific person. It's just the Midway Commission was assigned, or they took it upon themselves to present the entire life and teachings of Jesus in book four, part four of the Urantia book. So part four of the Urantia book picks up at paper 120. And from 120 to 196 are the complete collection of writings that carry us through the entire life of this man who lived in Nazareth 2,000 years ago, and whose birthday, by the way, we celebrate coming up on August 21st. And paper 196 is only three sections, which is interesting to me, because most other sections in the book are at least five. Very few, I'd have to do some research on this, but most of the Urantia book each paper is probably containing at least 5 or 6 sections. Now, interestingly enough, if you read paper 1, which is 7 sections, and they're the best 7 sections you'll ever read defining God, if you don't have any religious upbringing and you've never even thought once about deity, and it probably wouldn't be listening to this podcast, but if you were, and you just picked up and you had no prejudices, no bias, no preconditioning, no upbringing, if you were just an agnostic, secularist, and you picked up paper 1 and read the first paper, which is comprised of 7 sections, you would be convinced of one or two things. One, that the authors knew what they were talking about, and they speak with authority. And boy, is that authority, which I'll get to momentarily. But you would also be convinced that there's deity. You would be touched. Your spirit could, it would be impossible for you not to respond spiritually to paper 1 of the Urantia Papers. Now, interestingly enough, if you read the final paper, which is paper 196, which I will also read from, it is the most beautiful and dynamic presentation that explains the real religion, of Jesus, not the religion about him that we've been practicing for the last 2,000 years, that is really more of Paul's religion than it is Jesus's religion. You will find, again, it almost impossible to refute the authority of the authors, because the content is so rich, the text is so, I can't even put words to it. It's just such an unbelievable prose. And I challenge anyone, any scholar, any academic, any professed theologian, bring me something that has better detail than paper 196 as it explains the faith of Jesus. And interestingly, it is the final paper of the book, so it's the last part of this very long message. If the Urantia book is a revelation, which it asserts it is, indeed the fifth epical revelation, and these revelators, these authors that have been brought together from all places in the known universes, their experiences have been culled. They've been mandated to accomplish this mission, which is to put in words what you know about this aspect of cosmic reality. And that is what the Urantia book is. It is a contribution of many authors, personalities, spiritual but bona fide real personalities who come from the other side and share with us what they know about that particular area, what we might call their wheelhouse. And it is, and also their mandate requires them only to present that information which is not too far in advance of our, or what was our current level of understanding. So they can't tell us with too much specificity things that we haven't scientifically discovered for ourselves. They can reveal some things that perhaps were real close, and they have. Much of the astronomy that they present was just a little farther ahead than astronomy was in 1934. Things of biological nature, chemicals, we were only just coming out of, you know, we were basically at our baby steps with all this knowledge and science. I mean, it's really exploded in the last, 80 years because of the advent of computer technology and processing and the collective cooperative efforts of all scientists to bring their resources together. So science has really advanced. All fields of science have really advanced. But interestingly enough, they've advanced, but they haven't invalidated the Urantia Papers. And in one of my writings, which I had up on the ArranchoRadio.net blog, I talk about why science keeps stepping on its feet when it comes to explaining the evolution of man, human, the human species. We're stuck on this notion that, you know, human beings, modern man, came from Africa. And we find all these fossils, these records of hominids in Africa. And so we assume that that's where, and we find them more plentiful in Africa than in elsewhere. So the assumption is that's where we started. That is the cradle of early man. But the Urantia book very clearly says that while there were certainly all kinds of animal species, mid-mammals, semi-upright, mammalian, Homo, Homo erectus, Homo sibilis, it was the mind that differentiated modern man from his primate cousins, his animal cousins. It was the ability to worship. It was the ability to communicate ideas with his twin sister. And Andon and Fanta planned. They looked for outside help. They may have even uttered a prayer or looked for some sort of divine guidance. And that's what differentiated them between every previous human that had been born. So it was the activation of the two agitant mind spirits, the two final circuits, which registered our world as an inhabited planet, truly containing free will creatures with spirit potential. So science keeps trying to explain, well, you know, it's their explanation is slightly different, that mind elevated once modern man appeared. But the Urantia book says we progressed, but it was the evolution of the mind that brought us to where we could have the intellectual capacity to form, you know, civilization, the crude rudiments of civilization. Anyway, so my point is the Urantia book is still consistent with much of the science that is today. And if there's time, I'm going to dig up an article that I picked up just recently that talks about, I'll save it for later, but what the scientists are saying is that if you examine the molecular structure of these very small living particles that surround us, the architectural design of these structural entities that make up microcosmic life prove beyond the shadow of a doubt that it would have had to have been intellectually designed. There had to have been a designer. There is no way that life in its randomness could have constructed such a beautiful and perfect symmetrical silicon, and I don't even know what to call it, a microbe. Anyway, I'm probably wandering, but let me get to the point of this, which is we're lucky, for those of us who have the insight of the Urantia book, we're lucky that we have advanced copies of the playbook of what's up ahead. Aren't we? I mean, mankind, people, almost every writer of the Old and certainly the Old Testament, but the New Testament as well, every single author was on a search for God. Religion is a history. The Bible is a history of man's search for not only the truth, but of God. Because God is truth. God is the source of all truth. God makes truth possible. Without God, there is no truth. So just to give you an example, I was telling you in paper one, the Universal Father is the first chapter. The Universal Father is the name of the first chapter. The last chapter is named The Faith of Jesus. And it ends, and I'll share with you, well, I'll just go to it right now. It ends with, so again, if the first chapter is God the Father, here is the last line of the last chapter. The Father is living love, and this life of the Father is in his sons, and the Spirit of the Father is in his sons' sons, mortal men. When all is said and done, the Father idea is still the highest human concept of God. So it ties itself back to the original first paper, the Universal Father. Why? Because, and I read, the Universal Father is the God of all creation, the first source and center of all things and beings. Only the concept of the Universal Father, one God, in the place of many gods, enabled mortal man to comprehend the Father as divine creator and infinite controller. So it's essentially saying that is the highest concept that we can have, and thereby we designate God as being a Father. Now I want to read to you, in reference to what I stated before, that the Urantia book is a collection of personalities, celestial personalities, bona fide spiritual beings who possess identity and personality, and one day with whom we may see and have a conversation with. So the first five papers of the Urantia book are written by a divine counselor. And if you're somewhat familiar with the Urantia book, you'll understand the references. If you're not, bear with me. I'll try to expound on them. But it ends with paper one. There's an author footnote. And it says, presented by a divine counselor, a member of a group of celestial personalities assigned by the Ancients of Days on Uversa, the headquarters of the seventh universe, to supervise those portions of the forthcoming revelation which have to do with affairs beyond the borders of the local universe of Nabaddon. I am commissioned to sponsor those papers portraying the nature and attributes of God because I represent the highest source of information available for such a purpose on any inhabited world. I have served as a divine counselor in all seven of the super universes and have long resided at the paradise center of all things. Many times I have enjoyed the supreme pleasure of sojourn in the immediate personal presence of the Universal Father. I portray the reality and truth of the Father's nature and attributes with unchallengeable authority. I know whereof I speak. Okay, so if you're just a passerby on that, you may not really grab the full significance of what this divine counselor just told you. So the Ancients of Days, we know, are a tribunal. They are the judicial representative of law and justice. The Ancients of Days, by the way, are written about, referred to, not often, but they're in the Old Testament. So they serve as a board, a high board of authority. Actually, they're the only organization in the universe that can extinguish a human soul. They can determine whether you are in the book of life. They're the ones that mandated and authorized the Urantia book. So this is a committee of, I think, three. And they sit in the central universe, which is named Uversa. And they assigned a divine counselor to a task. And they went and they found the divine counselor that could best speak to the nature of the Universal Father. He says, I have served as a divine counselor, not only in just one of the super universes, but all seven. And this divine counselor also resides in paradise. And he has enjoyed the supreme pleasure of being in the immediate personal presence of the Universal Father. And he says, I know whereof I speak. Now that's a very authoritative statement. It's almost beyond the scope of the human ability to imagine that. I mean, what kind of being would this being have to be? Well, he's part of a group of celestial personalities. And divine counselors are of paradise origin. And it's just what the name says. They are counselors. They're divine counselors. They have identity. And this counselor represents the highest source. And he's sharing everything he knows to us about the same Father that mankind has been searching for hundreds of thousands of years. That should give you some indication as to the importance of the Urantia book. Or at least it should give you what it purports to be. And the importance of the Urantia book, if based on that, would be revolutionary. So you could say to yourself, well, if that's true, this is the book. If that is really true, that this divine counselor truly represents the highest source and has sat in the personal presence of God, the significance and the impact of that puts this book in a class all of itself. And that's why it's worth recounting. So I would recommend, even if you've read it before, pick up the book and read paper one, just the first section, the first seven subsections of paper one. And then when you're done with that, take a break and then go back and read the three sections of the religion of Jesus, the final papers, the faith of Jesus. Now, the faith of Jesus goes into what the church must do to reform itself in order for Jesus' truths to reignite the world. Man, I've talked to a lot of people today in the last few weeks, the last few months, really since the pandemic started. A lot of people have a lot of misgivings about the world right now. A lot of people are very afraid of where the world is headed and who's in charge and what's changing. Me, myself, I'm probably more concerned just about rights and liberty and how much deception there is and how much is true and how much isn't. And we don't know who's lying to us. And we don't. Some people are settled and they just believe whatever they are being told, and that's fine. But many people, like me, maybe even perhaps you, really are concerned about how things could quickly go bad and have gone bad and what it's going to take. You know, the Urantia book in the paper previous to this one, paper 195, talks about the crushing weight of materialism. And I've used the phrase, I don't know it exactly, but it says something like, you know, we're basically smothering ourselves with the weight of our own consumption and our supposed needs. Materialism is a crushing weight, and it's something that has to be, it's like feeding the monster. It has to be sustained. And at what point do the laws of diminishing returns start to, take effect? You know, would you say that the world is progressing right now? Would you say that the world is moving forward, or would you say that the world is moving backward? Well, I suppose it depends on what you use to determine that calculation. Is it a mathematical formula? Are more people doing better than not on our world? I would say no. I would say that the minority are the people who are doing fairly well. The majority are not doing well. The majority are living in tyranny. The majority are... Think of the hundreds of millions of people who starve. Think of the 1.4 billion people in India. Think of the 1.4 billion people in China who live day to day not knowing. But there are small groups in each of those countries that are doing very well. Less than half, probably more like 20 to 30%, I would say. I would say in every country there's probably at least 20 to 30% of the people who are living pretty well. You would consider it luxurious compared to the rest of the world. So does that mean we're compared to 100 years ago? Are there more people now who are doing well versus 100 years ago? So you could argue that, yeah, maybe we're making some progress. But the other metric that I measure is, you know, how much do we care for each other? And I see a lot more evil going on than goodness. I see people being abused in other countries, in our country. I see people being misled, being told to do things, not based on science, but on fear. And I also see a diminution of religion in people's lives. I see people as being hopeless. More people are hopeless today because they've been taught, they've been told that there is no God, that there is no universal truth, that you can only have your truth. Truth is somehow relative and could it's like a shapeshifter. You can apply it to whatever you want. You can create your own rules. So I see a lot of the Lucifer manifesto playing itself out in culture today. And as you know, if you've read the Lucifer Rebellion, what was his charge? Self-liberty. Do as you please. You know, you don't have anybody to answer to. Create your own course. Feel your power. You hear that a lot in radio and television all the time about the power thing. Feel the power. Every time you see a car commercial, feel the power. It's all about personal and aggrandizement and feeling the personal power. And it leads nowhere because that's not reality. I mean, it may be a part of reality, you know, but it's not the full reality. The full reality is that we are a small planet, a part of a much larger organization. And right now it almost appears as if we're spiritually dead. The lights are off. The beacon, the signal of the beacon is weak. You know, if Melchizedek were to come back today, you know, Jesus said he would come back. There's been a lot of talk, people, you know, maybe this is the tribulation period. Maybe Jesus is going to come back. Jesus says that he wouldn't come back until all eyes could see him. And we're far from that. There are not enough eyes that would recognize Christ if he came back. And so Melchizedek, who is predicted to come back before this, which we've talked about in previous podcasts, could come at any time. In fact, there's been a discussion that I've been having with several people about whether Melchizedek is the Messiah, the political deliverer. Because, see, the Jews don't recognize Christ or Jesus as being the Messiah because they were expecting a political deliverer. The prophets all spoke that this heir to the king of David would come and liberate the Jews from the yoke of the Roman oppressors. And that's what they were looking for. They were looking for a political deliverer. That's why Simon Zealots became an apostle. He thought he was part of the movement and that Christ was going to be that Messiah. And Christ himself knew that he could never live up to their political aspirations. His mission was personal. His mission was to reveal God to man and to reveal man to God. And this he accomplished. But the truths of what he spoke were lost in the adoration of the person of Jesus, as we know. The Christian church is about Jesus. It is about believing in Jesus. This is why so many people stumble, because they're told, just as they come up to the front door, the metaphorical front door of Christianity, and say, okay, well, the first thing you got to do is you've got to raise your right hand and you've got to say the following: I pledge myself to the Lord Jesus Christ, and I ask you to forgive all my sins. And that's the first thing you have to do when you enter the Christian church. And maybe that's fine. But let me read to you from paper 196, section 2, paragraph 1, from the Religion of Jesus. This distinguishes the Urantia perception of Christ versus the Christian perception of Christ. In this paragraph, or in these two paragraphs that I'm about to share with you, I'll explain that the religion of Jesus, as it is portrayed in the Urantia papers, is differentiated by this point I'm about to make. And it reads, someday a reformation in the Christian church may strike deep enough to get back to the unadulterated religious teachings of Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. You may preach a religion about Jesus, but perforce, you must live the religion of Jesus. In the enthusiasm of Pentecost, Peter unintentionally inaugurated a new religion, the religion of the risen and glorified Christ. The Apostle Paul later on transformed the new gospel into Christianity, a religion embodying his own theologic views and portraying his own personal experience with the Jesus of the Damascus Road. The gospel of the kingdom is founded on the personal religious experience of Jesus of Galilee. Christianity is founded almost exclusively on the personal religious experience of the Apostle Paul. Almost the whole of the New Testament is devoted not to the portrayal of the significant and inspiring religious life of Jesus, but to a discussion of Paul's religious experience and to a portrayal of his personal religious convictions. So what they're saying is that the religion of Jesus is different from the religion about Jesus. Mark, Matthew, and Luke retain something of the picture of the human Jesus as he engaged in this superb struggle to ascertain the divine will and to do that will. John the Apostle presents a picture of the triumphant Jesus as he walked on earth in the full consciousness of divinity. The great mistake that has been made by those who have studied the Master's life is that some have conceived of him as entirely human, while others have thought of him only as divine. Throughout his entire experience, he was truly both human and divine, even as he yet is. But the greatest mistake was made in that while the human Jesus was recognized as having a religion, the divine Jesus Christ almost overnight became a religion. Paul's Christianity made sure of the adoration of the divine Christ, but it almost wholly lost sight of the struggling and valiant human Jesus of Galilee, who, by the valor of his personal religious faith and the heroism of his indwelling adjuster spirit, ascended from the lowly levels of humanity to become one with divinity, thus becoming the new and living way whereby all mortals may so ascend from humanity to divinity. Mortals in all stages of spirituality and on all worlds may find in the personal life of Jesus that which will strengthen and inspire them as they progress from the lowest spirit levels up to the highest divine values, from the beginning to the end of all personal religious experience. And so you have this wonderful prose that points out the error of creating a religion about the risen Christ, which is a powerful message, and contrast that with the religion of Jesus, which is to follow his way of living, consecrated to doing the divine will, serving others. Those are the only two prerequisites, finding God and serving others. That's the religion of Jesus. That's the only thing that the... Imagine if the world could come to that awareness, that this isn't about... You know, because this is why there's so much religious division, because everybody wants to have these ceremonies and these practices and these things that they have to do instead of just accepting religion into your life and then operating with that premise of just having God in your life. That's what Jesus didn't separate his religious life from his regular life. They were combined. So, Jesus founded the religion of personal experience in doing the will of God and serving the human brotherhood. Paul founded a religion in which the glorified Jesus became the object of worship, and the brotherhood consisted of fellow believers in the divine Christ. In the bestowal of Jesus, these two concepts were potential in his divine human life, and it is indeed a pity that his followers failed to create a unified religion which might have given proper recognition to both the human and the divine natures of the Master as they were inseparably bound up in his earth life and so gloriously set forth in the original gospel of the kingdom. So this is the religious truth that anyone can follow. It's not a matter of being, an evangelist or being a Baptist or being a Catholic or being of any faith. It's that you have faith. Faith is the only thing that's required. And that's what Jesus not only taught, but he lived. He showed the world, indeed the universe, that man and God could live as one. And that's where I think we should leave it. It's been 30 minutes, and I'm always appreciative of your time. I hope I've given you a lot to ponder. I wanted to explore this. It is timely. People are looking for the truth in this world now more than ever. And I hold to this premise that when all is said and done, no matter what happens in this world, people are going to be coming looking for the truth. They're going to starve for the truth, and they need reassurance that this life is not being lived in vain. And I think the Urantia book offers a bridge to a new beginning of understanding of one's place in the universe. And always feel like you can reach out, urantiabookradio@gmail.com. urantiabookradio@gmail.com. I'll leave you with some nice music as we trail on into a future segment of the Urantia Papers on the Urantia Radio Podcast.